Hello, I'm Llewellyn King, the host of White House Chronicle, which is coming right up. But first, a few thoughts of my own. Baltimore. Baltimore has burned again. I said again because I was there when it burned in 1968 after the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. And it saddened me to see that so little had changed in Baltimore, that it remained a city of two societies, unequal and knowing little about each other. It was a very segregated city in 1968, but nobody thought about it. Certainly white people didn't think about it, and I don't believe black people thought about it. The white people averted their eyes to what was going on, and the only meeting point was some points of work, but the segregation was quite overt. Near the bar for the Hearst newspaper, the old News American, no longer published, there was a bar. There's always a bar near a newspaper. And I once witnessed the owner of the bar saying to an African American, "Oh, you can't come in, I'm so sorry, it's a private club, but I can sell you a bottle to go." It wasn't a private club, it was pure discrimination. So I approached an African-American journalist friend of mine, but he had other issues. He was working very hard and became quite famous in civil rights. His name was Lee Lassiter, but he did not feel that he wanted to fight that battle. The battle he was fighting was that the white licensing authorities were issuing too many licenses for bars and liquor stores in the African-American area, so that if there was any unhappiness in a conflagration, it tended to be fed with liquor, and that was not bad. That was not good, rather. That was extremely bad. And that's the world of Baltimore 68. Sadly, Baltimore 2015 doesn't seem much better. Two things that I always felt about Baltimore. One, that African Americans felt that their only way of articulating their frustration was through violence. And the other one was that there was a sadness to Baltimore that other cities didn't have. It had a sense of irreparable loss when it hadn't yet lost anything. It was beginning to lose manufacturing. There'd been a steel plant, there'd been an automobile plant, but the full horror of that had not yet descended, but the impending gloom informed everything. Also, the fact that it's so close to Washington, which was beginning to boom and to push out Baltimore, all of which affected the citizens of Baltimore, once the home of the great writer Mencken. It was a sadness then, and for me it was a double sadness now. I remember driving through the streets, I had a press plaque I could put in my car, looking at this, and the little things we did that we thought would repair, the little band-aids, social band-aids, like it was mentioned in the Washington Post at the time, when an African-American and a white driver arrived at an intersection and we waved each other, or they waved each other through, then felt they had done something significant. Sadly, nothing significant was done, and now Baltimore needs to rebuild again. I spent some very happy years in Baltimore. I would like to see it rebuild its soul as well as its buildings. Talking about rebuilding, our guest on this program today is a man who knows a thing or two about building. His name is Tom Paine, and it's a very famous name, and he's quite famous in his own way. He's an architect, but an architect of parks, public spaces, as well as buildings. Welcome to the broadcast. And
thank you.
I'm joined, as always, by our co-host on this program, Linda Gasparello. Linda, would you like to start the questions?
Yeah. So, Tom, how did you get into landscape architecture?
Well, as an undergraduate in college, I was fascinated with architecture. But I found that when it came time to write my thesis as a senior, I was writing about the Metropolitan Boston Water Supply System and how to make it more accessible to people. And it consisted of huge reservoirs connected by aqueducts, which were like footpaths, or footpaths in the making, or footpaths in my vision of how it could be. And so I realized, in fact, that I was looking at a whole landscape. And so I applied to the Department of Landscape Architecture at the Harvard Graduate School of Design. And the rest, as they say, is history. Here I am. So as a landscape architect, I distinguished myself not as being an architect. I got over wanting to do buildings. I decided the real game in town is what surrounds those buildings and tries to stitch them together in public space.
Do you watch the program on television, Parks and Recreation?
Well, I tend to limit my television watching, but I have a soft spot for Amy Poehler's take on how to run a Parks and Recreation Department or work with her colleagues and all the good that they try to do in public space and all the kinds of games and shenanigans that they have to deal with to make things happen. More than that, I can't say, but I think it's fair to say that it takes a lot of people's goodwill, best intentions, to make public space what it should be, to really do a good job of serving the people and providing them the kind of city that they deserve.
With a quick glance around the world, it would seem that public space was best understood in the 19th century. As the cities developed, there was land set aside for public space, particularly in Europe, but also in the United States, where there are parks that date back to that time. And of course, the greatest park of all in the U.S., probably Central Park. How did it save? It was saved from being a parking lot. Is a great story of, and we have some extraordinary parks right through Washington. Is Rock Creek Park, a sort of really a wild space with little bits of landscaping and a lot of stuff left as it was, and it's very used. In my observation, it's used for two reasons. People really like it because it's wild, and second, because you can park. It's very large. So if you want to have a picnic in a particular area, and they have places to put your picnic poles, etc., you can drive to it. And any Saturday in the summer or Sunday, you see people having a whale of a time in Rock Creek Park. But it's unique in that you can drive to it because it's so large and has a road running through it. Most parks you can't drive to, and they're not used so much for that sort of recreation because of that.
Well, I would say that Rock Creek Park is a parkway, which was an invention of Olmsted, who created Central Park, which you've mentioned. And he described a parkway not as a roadway, which is what we think of when we say the word parkway nowadays, but a parkway was actually a greenway corridor with a road running through it. That was a parkway. And Rock Creek Park is a beautiful example of a greenway corridor with a road running through it that provides an immersion experience. Either when you're driving, while you're driving, you can be at leisure, you're not surrounded by lots of unexpected visual cues. It's rather soothing, even as a driving experience, to be on a parkway as opposed to a normal city street. Or you can get out of your car and walk, ride your bike, go rollerblading. You can see the historic mill that's been preserved in Rock Creek Parkway. And you can do what I did. You can commute to work through it, which I did for many years when I was working as a developer in Washington.
Well, I used to commute to work by bicycle through it, and I used to ride horses there. Yeah. I kept a horse in Rock Creek. It's a very large park for those of our viewers and listeners who don't know that extends, really it bisects the city and goes deeply into Maryland. It's very extensive, and it has lots of beautiful little features, and you're always finding a new one.
But, Llewellyn, when you, just to mention the fact that you had said that a lot of the parks, a lot of the great parks were created in the 19th century. They were also created to service the elites. These were parks in France or in London where the elites could take their carriages, could parade their clothes. They weren't actually created for the working class people. Working class people were working at that time.
Well, you're not.
These were places to showcase.
Well, that's true.
To give the rich
a break
in cities. There were
parks, for example, Victoria Park, which was there for the recreation of workers in the East End of London, and it had very down-market features for the time. Like very inexpensive rowboats. No rich person would be seen in one of those rowboats or eating an ice cream or listening to an oompah band. No, I think you're partially right, but I think that there were parks set aside for people, and that was true in England, and it was part of the tradition of the British. I grew up in Africa, and the first thing they built in Harare, the capital of Zimbabwe, from whence I hail originally, was a nice park with a lot of very good features. It was built in the early part of the 20th century, but it was for the enjoyment of the people across the board. And earlier, somebody asked me whether Africans were allowed into it, and the answer is yes. It was integrated. It wasn't very much used by Africans for different reasons, but yes, the idea of the park, I always thought, was for everybody. You did have Rotten Row in London, where they took their carriages and rode their horses. And
in Paris, you had the Tuileries Garden, you had the Bois de Boulogne, and those were all really for the elites.
Yeah. Well, let me just jump in and say that Olmsted went to, when the Bois de Boulogne was being constructed, he was a visitor there, and he realized that this park was being provided, you could say, for the elite, who could get there by carriage. But I think it's fair to say that large country parks were being provided with an end in mind, that it was to be open to all. There were not going to be French barricades on the roads preventing the French people from going to these parks, and they were going to get there. Mm-hmm. And Central Park as well. Olmsted, in his view, was very conscious of the mingling of people from all walks of life together. They could learn from each other. The rich could actually learn a thing or two about the poor conditions in their city, mm-hmm. and want to be inspired to do something about it. The poor, on the other hand, could look how the rich people lived and how they behaved, and maybe they learned a few things.
It was a show.
Yeah, it was a show.
And I think Glenda may not be quite right, because I think the British park tradition came from the village green, the concept of commons, of common shared land, which was very part of the British tradition.
Well, we had the commons here. We had Boston Common. It was, you know, that was part of the British tradition.
The
parks that we think of in France were...
Oh, you're thinking of the gardens at Versailles.
Well,
tell us more. We have the expert here. And you've been teaching the Chinese how to build open spaces. Should we call them open spaces?
Yes, we should.
And you have this extraordinary book, which is in Chinese and English, and which you can get by going to the website, which is on the screen.
Cities with Heart.
And it's called Cities with Heart by our guest. And it's quite a beautiful thing with some wonderful pictures. What is your favorite park?
My favorite park in the world, it's a really hard question, but let me just say that my sentimental favorite, for all the abuse that it's taken, is the Boston Common, which is the oldest public park, some would say, in the world. It was never a royal park. It was never associated with a palace. It was always the park of the people. It had London-inspired malls along the edge of it in the 1750s, and it became known as a park, really, when Park Street got named, being next to it, in 1808. So before 1830, it was a park, and that is well before the public parks in England, which most people don't realize. So people say it's the first park in America. I would argue it's probably the first public park in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So is it the most beautiful park? No, it's got a ways to go. It's a work in progress. Among recent parks, I have to say one of my favorites is Millennium Park in Chicago. It's a wonderful use of public art that is totally engaging of the public. They interact with it. They want to hang around. You've got the fountain with the two spouts, and people's images can be uploaded to the LED bricks, and they can see their own images if they wait around spouting that water. Or you've got the Indian bean, I guess it's called, the wonderful reflective bean-shaped sculpture that reflects the skyline of Chicago, and people just love to be photographed there for their weddings. They love to sit under it and gaze up at it. It's a miracle.
Around the world, people are drawn to these spaces if they're provided. In Buenos Aires is the mechanical flower.
It's a Proteus that opens up as the sun shines and as the sun sets. It's amazing.
Light sensitive, but it's a great metal sculpture that moves. It's a beautiful thing. And people go to that park, if that's the right word. And people have always enjoyed using areas along rivers, et cetera, for recreation.
Right. But what is the Chinese tradition of parks? Did it not begin as an imperial tradition? I mean, parks and gardens were mostly the parks and gardens that you think in imperial China.
Of the elite, you could say. But in fact, in putting my book together, I wanted to take a global perspective on the history of urban public open space. And one of the things I was reminded of is that when Marco Polo and his uncle were in Hangzhou in the, I guess it's the 12th century. They saw Westlake, and already there were boats taking the public out to the island to recreate and to get a meal. And if that's not public park use, I don't know what is, and that's in the 12th century. So I would argue that if we broaden the definition of park, you could say that China has had at least that public park that long ago. Did it become a national phenomenon? Was it prevalent in their culture? No, I don't think so. And that only came in the 19th century, about the time that Olmsted was advocating Central Park. And by the way, he was partially inspired by his trip as a 21-year-old sailor to Guangzhou in 1843. He never forgot the kindness of Chinese people.
When we come back, I want you to tell us more about Olmsted. We've mentioned him, but rather by without centrally introducing him. This is for the benefit of our listeners, a small commercial break, if you will, or at least a small break, for the benefit of our listeners on Sirius XM Radio, Channel 124, the POTUS Channel. You are listening to White House Chronicle with myself, Llewellyn King, Linda Gasparello of this program, and our guests today, Tom Paine, a landscape architect who has worked extensively in China as well as around the U.S. and in Europe. And this program can be seen on 200 television stations in the United States and around the world on the English language television stations of the Voice of America and sometimes on their radio programs as well. Tell us about Olmsted. He's come up inadvertently almost, but he's central to our discussions.
He is, and talk about China.
What was his full name to begin with?
Frederick Law Olmsted. Grew up in a well-to-do, not rich, but well-off enough family in Connecticut. Didn't know what he wanted to do in life, and as a 21-year-old, shipped out on a merchant ship to Guangzhou and spent time.
Guangzhou is whereabouts?
It's
in
called
China?
Canton. It was called Canton.
And so Canton,
as an ordinary sailor, was deeply moved by the kindness extended towards him as a total stranger of no status. They invited him into their shops and their homes, their gardens, their shipyards and temples, and he never forgot it. And 12 years later, when he had this vision for people's parks, he accorded part of his inspiration to that experience, and the rest of it, of course, to his visits to the parks in England and in France that I mentioned earlier. So he was inspired by the idea that people from all walks of life could experience what he called, when he was talking about China, civility, just a simple matter of civility, by behaving in ways in public space that simply were not developed or encouraged in other parts of a normal workday, in other parts of a normal neighborhood. But by strangers getting together, they could experience what Barnaby Evans of Providence, Rhode Island, who created Waterfire, has called communitas. Communitas is this experiencing of feeling connected to each other, a feeling of a sense of community, which how can you build that if you don't have public space? You can't build it by sitting at home with your tribe. You have to get out more. And that's what public space lets you to do. It lets you get out more.
In your own history, what are you particularly proud of that you've created?
Well, I would have to say that through much of my experience, I found that I was a writer of nothing more glorious than guidelines for public open space. And throughout my career, I have worked on several projects that I'm particularly proud of. I'll just mention one, which is in the world's first garden cemetery, called Mount Auburn Cemetery in Boston. And I worked on a small project called Willow Pond Knoll. But I'm quite convinced that the design that we came up with was channeling fusion design, east and west design. Holmes has a Taoist spiral feel to it. It's a place of burial overlooking a pond. It has feng shui. It has this harmonious relationship to its environment. And I've been flattered that the people who have chosen to be buried there have put inscriptions in Chinese and English and Korean and languages from all over the world, because they understand the feng shui and they're coming from all these different cultures. So for me, it was a project that brought different cultures together in one shared understanding of humanity. And that for me is the whole purpose That's our mission as designers, is to bring the world together, to share culture across cultures, and to see what we, how much we have in common, in common space. So that is a small project, but it came out beautifully. And I've worked on other projects. I've overseen many projects, and they all have their issues. It's a work in progress, shall we say. But I'm a modest guy. I don't like to boast.
What is it like working on landscape projects in China these days? I'm interested in how Xi Jinping views landscape architecture. I know what he thinks about some modern architecture. He recently said that enough of weird buildings, you know, that he wants peaceful, he wants restful, he wants... I would think that he would very much want to have public spaces, you know, that are restful, that help people to work, etc.
My understanding is he absolutely would want that and does want that. And I think not only Xi Jinping, but the mayors of the cities, who are really the decision leaders in the provision of a public open space, are very much on board with this. The question is, do they have the resources and do they know what they really want, which is why I wrote the book, because there are certain things that, that need to be considered to have a really clear understanding of what is at stake, what is at risk, and how can we avoid squandering precious resources. For example, I was talking to the mayor of Guangzhou, Chen Jianhua, and mentioning the Olmsted example and saying, wouldn't it be great if we could celebrate in public space how much we've got in common. We could celebrate Olmsted's visit here to Guangzhou, which has meant so much for the world, and here in China where we have people's parks and need to provide a lot more of them. We could also celebrate Sun Yat-sen in public space, a Chinese who came to America, was inspired by Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, of the people, by the people, for the people, and then created the three principles of the people that is at the foundation of modern China. We have so much to share that we don't appreciate, and public space is a perfect place to do it. So the support was there, and the mayor said, I can't believe this. And the next day in the public papers, it's in the Guangzhou Daily, it said, because I talked about Olmsted's visit to Guangzhou and how he had built Central Park, the next day in the papers it said, Guangzhou helps inspire Central Park. It was a headline in the newspaper. Well, it was a stretch, but close enough.
Well, I've been fortunate enough to be in parks all around the world, and they do tend to have a European legacy to them, though it's not always clear. For example, there are beautiful parks in Turkey. It's not clear to me that it's a European influence. But otherwise, in Vietnam, which has lovely parks, those are part of the French influence, etc. Scattered around the world, we have parks. But what I do notice, and which is concerning, I think, is that in our new development, our edge cities, our suburbs turned into cities, mm-hmm. there's no space for parks. There are no parks. They're little pocket parks, but they're not great Hyde Park, Central Park.
This is a missed opportunity, and as the book points out, parks should be considered part of a system, and they should be connected. There should be greenway corridors, and they can provide ecological services, for example. We're going to be needing a whole lot more ways to drain floodwaters out of a lot of low-lying cities in the very near future, and those greenway corridors providing that ecological service can also be people space the rest of the time, or maybe even during if you're out in a kayak. But they need to be more connected. Don't need to be so scattered. We need neighborhood parks, but parks work best when they're considered as part of a connected tissue that flows through the life of the city.
Do you think it's better for people to live densely with parks, or to do what we've been doing really since the Second World War, which is taking half an acre, a quarter of an acre, putting a house on it, and getting the green that way, but where only the owner of the house can enjoy the green?
Well, I would be a hypocrite if I said that if I denied the fact that I do live in a garden suburb myself. But I, as a person of a certain age, I'm looking to move back into the city. And I think that 20-somethings and millennials are very interested in living in startup and working in startup companies. They're living downtown. They don't want to even own cars, and they need parks, and they need to live densely, more densely than the suburbs, and they need lots of public open space, and they should not have to walk more than 10 minutes to get to it. That should be the way cities should be built, but it's so often not the case. So garden suburbs are a kind of anachronism moving forward. It's not going to be like that. People don't even want to mow their lawns. We're not going to be able to afford to keep those lawns mowed. We're not going to be able to afford the irrigation. The water is going to be in short supply in California. It's already happening. What about all those lawns in California? It's going to be interesting.
Well, what are you going to do, knock down the houses to build apartments? I don't think so.
It's going to be a slow transition. I cannot tell you how it's going to work, but real estate is valuable. There will be a way to make it to be more densely settled, and yet for there to be open space provided in the midst of that increased density.
Well, a country like China has been one of the few countries that has been able to build cities from the ground up. When they build their new cities, are parks built into these cities, or are they not built into them? Because if they build a city, the population density will come immediately. And so when you get that population density, you really do need parks in order to allow people to get into the fresh air. You know, it helps health, it helps their, you know, certainly their, you know, the work they do, it helps their lives that they've got these parks. But are they being built, or are they being designed at this point with parks included or not?
Well, they're absolutely doing what they think they need to do to provide what they think is a sufficient park space. But there are so many outlying suburban areas, even in China, that are not served by decent parks. And where these people, in order to get to a decent park, are going to have, and they don't all own cars, not by a long shot, mm-hmm. are going to have to hop in a bus and go someplace for half an hour to get there, so they're not going to go.
No.
And they've got no place to go. And if we think, you know, we've got issues with our lifestyle, just try living in a cubicle and working in a cubicle and having no place to go.
Right.
It's not a healthy lifestyle. And this I would say, is much more of a problem in the Class B and Class C cities in China and cities in many developing countries in the rest of the world. It's not our problem in the first world. We tend to have lots of layers of open space that we can go to. We're very, very lucky. So we shouldn't be whining about a lack of open space here compared to conditions in other parts of the world where even the minimum that's being provided is way, way insufficient. And it's not really being addressed properly or sufficiently, even by the World Health Organization, which did a recent study and cited maybe 0.9 hectares per 1,000 people might be enough. But that's like 5 cents on the dollar of what's really needed.
Wow.
So it is not being taken seriously enough.
And is it being taken seriously in the rest of the world enough?
I'm saying that it is something that we have considered as something that is nice to have, but in fact it is essential, and we're only starting to get there in terms of our understanding of it. We tend to favor parking lots over parks, and that is the whole problem.
We're out of time. The book is Cities with Heart. The author is Tom Paine. Last remark, Linda, you can have the last word.
And saying for a first world city, I think London is doing a lot to bring the park back into with the greenways that they're building.
And don't underestimate Washington. When you think
that's
of all
too.
Of the parkland in Washington, that's our show for today. See you in the park. Until then, cheers.